Okay, we've gotten started into 1 Kings chapter 8, which also follows there with 2 Chronicles chapter 5. And last week we read the first 8 verses from 1 Kings chapter 8. And we want to go ahead and see the parallel verses at the beginning of 2 Chronicles chapter 5 to start with. And let's go ahead and ask Brother Yon to read verses 1 through 9 from 2 Chronicles 5.
Thus all the work that Solomon made for the house of the Lord was finished. Solomon brought in all the things that David's father had dedicated, and the silver and the gold and all the instruments put him on the treasures of the house of God. Since Solomon was civil, the elders of Israel and all the heads of the tribes, the chief of the fathers of the children of Israel, went to Jerusalem to bring up the ark of the covenant of the Lord out of the city of David, which is Zion. Wherefore, all the men of Israel assembled themselves unto the king in the feast, which was in the seventh month. And all the elders of Israel came, and the Levites took up the ark. And they brought up the ark and the tabernacle of the congregation, and all the holy vessels that were in the tabernacle, these that the priests and the Levites bring up. Also, King Solomon and all the congregation of Israel that were assembled unto him before the ark sacrificed sheep and oxen, which could not be told nor numbered for multitude. And the priests brought in the ark of the covenant of the Lord unto his place, to the oracle of the house, and to the most holy place, even unto the wings of the cherubims. For the cherubims spread forth their wings over the place of the ark, and the cherubims covered the ark, and the staves thereof above. And they drew out the staves of the ark, and the ends of the staves were seen from the ark before the oracle, but they were not seen without. And there it is unto this day.
Okay, so this goes along with those first 8 verses of 1 Kings 8, but as we're seeing in both these accounts, the work of the temple is complete. The details that Hiram finished and all of that, including the porch and everything, was all done now, and everything was ready. Vessels were all prepared and made. And then there were all those things that David had prepared. Of course, the materials he got ready for the building. And Solomon used that. So David's preparation for that enabled the building of the temple to be completed in a much quicker fashion. As we recall, going back to the end of chapter 6 and beginning of chapter 7 in 1 Kings, foundation for the temple was laid in the fourth year of King Solomon. It was completed in the 11th year, and so it was 7 years in building, whereas Solomon's own palace took 13 years to build after that. So why would a building as magnificent as the temple take roughly half the time as Solomon's house? Well, a big part of that was how much work had David already done to prepare for that. That's what he had spent most of his reign doing. But also, as we saw at the end of those last several chapters, at the end of the book of 1 Chronicles, where it went into the details of that, all the preparations that David had made, and all the things that he had dedicated himself and from the people to go into the Lord's treasury there in the temple when it was finished. In fact, the last chapter of 1 Chronicles, that would be chapter 29, gave a lot of details about that, and also gave us another view of the good heart that David had. You may recall back in 1 Chronicles chapter 29 and verse 2, David spoke there about how he had prepared with all of his might for the house of his God, the gold and silver and all those other things in that verse that he'd mentioned. And he said because he had set his affection to the house of the Lord there in verse 3 of 1 Chronicles 29. And he went into the details with that. And the reaction that the people had for that was recorded in 1 Chronicles 29 and verse 9. And Brother Peter, can you go back there just to refresh ourselves? Because those verses that Brother John just read mention these things that this chapter in 1 Chronicles is about, that David had prepared for the temple as well as the other items, but in the construction of the building itself. But Brother Peter, can you read 1 Chronicles 29 and verse 9?
Then the people rejoiced that they offered willingly, because every part they offered willingly to the Lord, and David the king also rejoiced with great joy.
Okay, and then verse 14 as well, that's David's prayer of thanksgiving for this.
Who am I, and what is my people, that we should be able to offer so willingly after this sword? All things come from thee, and thine only, and given thee.
All right, so here this was David's heart, and you can see the effect it had on the people. So it encouraged the whole nation, and everybody was willingly giving for this cause. And what did David acknowledge there? I mean, they were giving. Whose was it anyway? I mean, it had been given to them by the Lord, and so is that a bad thing to take of what the Lord has provided for us and use it for the Lord? That's what we should be doing, and so that's what David did and what the people did. We're seeing the fruits of that here now that the temple has been completed, and so those things are brought in. But we have this situation here. Now, the people of the Lord, as have mentioned, kind of have the outline from the judges, beginning with Moses, and of course Joshua succeeded him. I've got a few errors there because I skipped names from Joshua to Samuel. We don't have all of them anyway. But that would include ones that are that we're told about, particularly in the book of Judges. There's Ehud. There was Deborah. There was Gideon and Jephthah and Samson. All of those throughout the period of the judges, right up to the last one, who was Samuel, who was also, of course, called by God as a prophet. And Samuel was the one that anointed Saul and David, the first two kings of Israel. So his life spanned all the way to when the people decided they didn't want a judge anymore, but would rather have a king. Of course, Samuel took that as a personal rejection, but who were they really rejecting? But God. He was the one that gave them the judges. But it was during Solomon's early years, when he was still very young, when God first spoke to him in 1 Samuel chapter 3, when he was in the tabernacle at Shiloh. And who was the high priest then? Eli. God spoke to Samuel and said his name, and then where did Samuel go? To Eli. Eli sent him back to bed, and then the voice came again. He ran to Eli again. Finally, Eli perceived it must be the Lord, and so he instructed him to say, "Here am I, your servant hears you," and he did say that, and God then gave the first prophecy to this young guy that he was now calling as a prophet. And that prophecy was what? Well, that the house of Eli was going to be destroyed. Because Eli had not restrained his sons, who were wicked, Hophni and Phinehas. And it was going to span, and to fulfill that prophecy, span actually all the way to the beginning of Solomon's reign. Because we remember when Solomon became king, Abiathar was the high priest, and he exiled Abiathar to the city of Anathoth and removed him from the priesthood, and Zadok became the sole priest. That signified the change from Abiathar was the last of the house of Eli, and then Zadok was the beginning of a different family of the families of Aaron for the high priesthood, because they were of a different. You remember Aaron? How many sons did Aaron have? Four. First two were very notorious, Nadab and Abihu, and they offered strange fire before the Lord, and the Lord gave them some fire of his own back, and that was the end of them, and they did not have offspring. So that left two sons, Eleazar and Ithamar. And Ithamar was the one that the house of Eli descended from. Well, Zadok was from the other son of Aaron. So they were from the two different major families of Aaron that they descended from. So that was the changeover that the Lord had prophesied about all the way back in Samuel's days. So from Samuel to Solomon, during this time, I mean, you're talking about a roughly 100-year period of history in Israel. Well, that period of about a century also coincided with what? Well, what was the sign that God gave to Solomon, that whole prophecy? Because when he's giving a prophecy that was going to take about 100 years to fulfill, how many of the people that would hear those words would be around to see all of it? Basically nobody. So for those who heard it to begin with, how would they know that God was going to do all of it when they wouldn't be around to see all of it? And this is something that God would do from time to time, especially for prophecies that were going to be over an extended period of time, to give the proof right at the beginning that it was all going to happen. He would give a sign. And he did in that case. What would be the sign for them to say, okay, God was doing this and would do all of what he said? What would happen in one day? He told Samuel, all this is in 1 Samuel 3. I wish we had time to go read all of this now, but we don't. But anyway, just refreshing a little bit. But God said that the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, would both fall. They would both die together on one day. That was going to happen soon. And in fact, it was the next chapter, 1 Samuel 4. They were killed by the Philistines in battle that the Israelites lost. When Hophni and Phinehas brought the Ark of the Covenant into the camp of Israel, saying that it would give them the victory over the Philistines because they had just lost a battle before that. Well, they were lost because they were wicked and they didn't repent, so they didn't fix what the problem was. So bringing the Ark of the Covenant in did not help. In fact, what happened that day? Not only did Hophni and Phinehas die, but the Philistines won that battle and they took the Ark. And they took it back to their own land. When that news was brought to Eli, who was an old man at that time, he fell backwards out of his chair, his neck broke, and he died. Then his daughter-in-law went into premature labor, and she died giving birth to Ichabod, the name meaning the glory of God had departed from Israel that day. So that was a tragic day in Israel's history. But at that time, we also know, based on what we have from other scriptures, it would fit during that time that not only was the Ark of the Covenant taken, but what about the tabernacle in Shiloh itself? It was gone. So now, going all the way back to Moses' time, when God gave the law, whose idea was it to have a tabernacle? I mean, that came from God. And the pattern of the tabernacle came from God. And it was very specific in that they had the designated areas, the holy place, where only the priests could go, and they would do that every day, where the table would be and the golden candlestick and the showbread and those things. They had their daily sacrifices. The priests would go in there daily, only the descendants of Aaron. Then there was the most holy place that only the high priest could go into once a year. What was in that place? It was only on the Day of Atonement that the high priest could go by himself to make atonement, and he would sprinkle the most holy place with blood and for his own sins, for the sins of the nation. You can refresh on Leviticus 16 on all of that. But what was in the most holy place? Going back to the pattern that God had given Moses that they completed for the tabernacle, that they had to move place to place after they made it in the wilderness while they wandered for those 40 years until they finally came into the land, and God divided it by lot, and God chose, in Judges chapter 19, the beginning of that chapter, God chose Shiloh as the location, the permanent location for the tabernacle. So that's when that was set up during Joshua's time. But the tabernacle, what had that most holy place, what was in it? They had the cherubims, that their wings would go from two of them. Their wings were outstretched. The tip of one would be on the wall at one end, and then the other wing tip touched the one of the other cherubim, and then the outside of the other wing of that one to the other wall. So it spanned the width of the tabernacle, and then there was the mercy seat, and what was there with that? That's where the Ark of the Covenant was. And so all of that was in the most holy place. Okay, well, what happens when the Ark of the Covenant has been removed from the tabernacle by Hophni and Phinehas? Then it's taken by the Philistines and the tabernacle is destroyed. That happened in 1 Samuel 4, that separation where you did not have the Ark of the Covenant in its place in the tabernacle. Well, now you have no tabernacle at all. And of course, for several months, no ark until the Philistines got rid of it because of how God plagued them. Well, then what happened? They sent the ark back to Israel, and it first went to Beth Shemesh until the people there looked in it. And you had the 50,000 something that got killed for looking in the ark there, and then they sent it to Kirjath Jearim, and it stayed there. Well, through the rest of Samuel's time, through the entire reign of Saul, until we get to the reign of David. David conquers Jerusalem, makes that his city, destroyed the Jebusites who had been there, and then he built a temporary location for the ark. So the ark was then brought into Jerusalem by David, but there was a tabernacle, another replacement tabernacle was in Gibeon. That's where Solomon was sacrificing when God appeared to him and gave him that opportunity to make request of whatever he desired from the Lord. And he asked for a wise and understanding heart judging the people. So you had a tabernacle in one location and you had the Ark of the Covenant in another. So from 1 Samuel 4 all the way to now, God didn't allow David to build the temple. That was David's idea then. David wanted this problem solved that had been around now for going on 100 years to have not just a new tabernacle, but a temple, a permanent, a magnificent permanent building wherein would be the Ark of the Covenant. God was pleased with that plan and approved it, but would not allow David to build it. That's when he prepared all the materials. Solomon is the one that's built that. That's what we're seeing now. And at this point, what does it tell us when the temple's completed? The priests bring the Ark of the Covenant. Of course, there's no tabernacle now. Now we have a temple, and the Ark is brought in there. And it's in its place where the cherubim are, mercy seat and all of that. So this is culminating the fixing of a giant problem that Israel has had for about 100 years. And based on the law of Moses, I mean, how many different commandments were they unable to obey over the course of that 100 years when you didn't have the Ark of the Covenant in its place, in the most holy place, and there was no tabernacle with that? I mean, this was out of order for the Israelites, and this is what Solomon, you remember back in, since we're in Second Chronicles right now, back in chapter 2 and verse 4, remember when Solomon was speaking to Hiram, the king of Tyre, and said, "Behold, I build a house to the name of the Lord my God, to dedicate it to him and to burn before him sweet incense, and for the continual showbread, and for the burnt offerings morning and evening, on the Sabbaths and on the new moons, also on the solemn feasts of the Lord our God." This is an ordinance forever to Israel. That includes the Day of Atonement, all those things. Had they been able to do those things that he mentions there for all that time, for about 100 years? I mean, that's a terrible thing. Of course, the answer is no. And what a terrible thing for the nation. That's why that was such a priority for David. I mean, how did David feel about all these commandments of God for the whole nation? And all of these commandments were to have the people kept near to God. It was during these times when he would have the law read to the people. I mean, this was integral to the nation of Israel to know the Lord and to know his ways so that they could walk in them. What a hindrance. What a hindrance it was for the nation spiritually over that period of time. How did David feel about that? Well, obviously, he had no rest in his spirit over that particular issue. And so everything he was doing, he was driven to solve that number one problem in the nation, which was a spiritual issue for Israel. Well, now it's fixed. So this is a huge moment. That problem has now been solved, finally. God has blessed this situation so that they are now in a situation, a position to be able to obey all of those commandments that the Lord had given to them. All right, let's Brother Ted, can you read 2 Chronicles chapter 5 and verse 10, the next thing that it states at this time? Having brought the ark in there, he now tells us what's in it. Okay, so what's in the Ark of the Covenant right now? Well, what was in there to start with? The two tables of stone. These are the Ten Commandments, the originals. They were in the Ark of the Covenant. Now you talk about an important object for Israel. The actual stones were the commandments, those Ten Commandments were written by whose finger? By the finger of God. So here are the tables of stone where God himself had engraven those commandments for Israel. That's in the Ark of the Covenant. Is that something that everybody, they would all go around to get to look at? No. But the important thing was they were there, and the people knew that. What does that signify? What was that Ark of the Covenant in its proper place that God had commanded there, where the mercy seat was in the most holy place? That all signified the authority of God. As we just read in 2 Chronicles 2:4, as Solomon understood that this was something to the name of the Lord, according to the authority of God. So God's authority rested there, and that was signified by that most holy place, by the Ark of the Covenant, and the law that was in it. All of that is telling the people, this is of God. The God of heaven has done all of this, and this is his authority, and it's represented there in those stones that were in that Ark of the Covenant. So when they would gather there as God commanded, and as they would come to Jerusalem before that building three times a year, they had those thrice yearly reminders of this, at least on those occasions. That's why this was so important, reminded of God's authority. Okay, well, there are the two tables of stone that were in there that went in there originally when it was made. What else? That's what's in it right now. Is that all that was ever in it?
Aaron's rod and a lot of manna.
Are you making that up? No, he's not. Hebrews chapter 9, if we can go over there for a moment. Yes, God's word states exactly what he was just quoting scripture. Hebrews chapter 9 and verse 4. Well, let's go ahead and it'd be good to remind ourselves, because this is again going over these things that are being remedied now at this time. Let's read from Hebrews chapter 9, verses 1 through 8. Hebrews 9, One day, Brother Tom.
Then verily, the first covenant had also ordinance of divine service and worldly sanctuary. For there was a tabernacle made, the first, wherein was the candlestick, and the table, and the showbread, which is called the sanctuary. And after the second veil, the tabernacle, which is called the holiest of all, which had the golden censer, and the ark of the covenant, overlaid round about with gold, wherein was the golden pot that had manna, and Aaron's rod that budded, and the tables of the covenant, and over it the cherubims of glory shadowing the mercy seat, of which we cannot now speak particularly. Now, when these things were thus ordained, the priest went always into the first tabernacle, accomplishing the service of God. But into the second went the high priest alone once a year, not without blood, which he offered for himself and for the errors of the people. The Holy Ghost, this signifying that the way into the holiest of all was not yet made manifest, while as the first tabernacle was yet standing.
Now he's going here back to the original tabernacle, the tent that was made. We have such a limited amount of time. I wish we could read all these. I know we've referred to different chapters and places. But another one is Exodus 26 is where God gave the commandment for the building of the tabernacle and gave all those particulars that are just outlined right there in Hebrews 9. But you can go back and read the original, which is now being restored in this temple at this point of our reading. That's why we're going over this. It ties into exactly where we are in our study in 1 Kings and 2 Chronicles. Now it's a temple. But all of this is still going back to that original, what God had established there, going back to Exodus 26 when he gave the commandment for the pattern of the tabernacle and for the Ark of the Covenant. And those two tables of stone were put in there. He mentions that most holy place. He mentions the Ark of the Covenant, the cherubim, the mercy seat, and all those. And that the high priest himself could only go into the most holy place that one time a year on the Day of Atonement. Now, all of this was important for Israel as this was God's authority, and this was crucial for them to hear God's word and to be able to follow and obey those commandments of the Lord. It also bears significance for us because God was signifying from all of that. I mean, there was a reason he designed that the way that he did. There was a reason why he had a most holy place. There was a reason why he had a Day of Atonement and why it was every year and with a high priest. I mean, designing a high priest, all of that. Those were all shadows. And it signified at the time what it was a shadow of wasn't in existence yet. Because if it were, and this is a big point, not just in this chapter of Hebrews, but going back even into chapters 6, 7 through 8, and we'll keep going on into 10 from there. So you have these middle chapters there in the book of Hebrews that are very much focused on this issue. Well, who is the actual high priest after the order of Melchizedek? Jesus Christ is our high priest after the order of Melchizedek. Not after the order of Aaron, which is what he's talking about here, because those priests, they had to offer for their own sins, that priesthood. I mean, they wouldn't, well, we already talked about it, changing from one house of the families of Aaron to another, from Eli to Zadok, but not just that, but the high priest himself, even within a family. I mean, who was high priest before Eli? And who was high priest after Eli? And then after him and after him? I mean, how long would somebody be a high priest? One would, much like with kings, but when a high priest would die, it wouldn't necessarily be his son, but there would, that was often the case, but there would be, when one would die, another would be appointed that still had to be of the descendants of Aaron, but then another would be in that office until that one died, and then another would exist. So how many high priests were there from the order of Aaron. Well, we don't even know the number, but many, 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 many of them. Well, that, Hebrews 7 talks about how different that was than this priesthood of Christ. His is an enduring one. He has been the high priest since he was made so by the Father, and he will persist in that office. There's not going to be anyone to succeed him in that office, much like his kingship. There's not going to be another king to supplant him, so he is king and high priest and will always be such over us. But what was the most holy place in the tabernacle and now the temple? What was that a figure of? What is the actual most holy place of all, as we're taught in Hebrews, that Jesus entered into once for all time, having sacrificed himself once for all? Heaven itself, and that's in this ninth chapter of the book of Hebrews also. Again, wish we had time to read the whole chapter right now, but that's where Jesus went. And that's what was signified by that most holy place. But the fact that there was a high priest, that office would change. He could have to go in there year after year. Was there a way in existence at that time for as it mentions there in verse 8 here in Hebrews chapter 9, a way into the holiest place of all while that building was still standing? Wasn't in existence yet. And the ultimate sacrifice was not yet made. Christ did not yet come. So there were things lacking that was also signifying, that Christ fulfilled and brought into existence. But there were many things that were important about that original tabernacle and now the temple. But in all of this, he mentions in verse 4, the objects that originally were in the Ark of the Covenant. Well, first, the tables of stone, because those were the first. There's really, how many objects does he mention there that were in there? Three. And they went in there in sequence as they were made. What was the first of those three objects that existed? Or the tables of stone? The Ten Commandments came first, so that was in first. Then next, what came, in fact, of course, the tables of stone were made before the ark itself was made. But as soon as the ark was made, those tables of stone went in there. What was next? Well, the next thing that came into existence, and that was in, actually, you're right. It didn't go in there yet because the ark didn't exist yet. But you're right, the manna fell. That was in Exodus 16 when the manna started to fall and they were preserved a pot of it. So he's right in order, because the Ten Commandments came. That's Exodus 20. So you had the pot of manna and then you had the Ark of the Covenant, and both of those things God said would go in there. And then in Numbers 17. What did God do to signify to all the tribes and to the other families of the tribe of Levi that God authorized only Aaron and his descendants to be the high priest in Israel? He made Aaron's rod a stick to bud and bear almonds. And there were sticks with all the other tribes' names on them that remained sticks, like all other sticks do. But God did a miracle with that one that had Aaron's name there, and so he had that to be included originally. So you had those three objects: the tables of stones, that pot of manna, and the rod of Aaron that budded. Well, all of those have to do with God's authority, right? I mean, the giving of the law, who sustained them miraculously through all of their time in the wilderness, delivered them from Egypt, kept them alive, sustained them all the way through until they came into the land of Canaan. That was God. Was that signified by that pot of manna? Yes. And then his authority for the nation and the priesthood, that was signified there. So, I mean, there were great points about the authority of God and all those objects. Now, by the time we've reached the building of the temple, where's the pot of manna and the rod of Aaron? Don't know. It's interesting that he mentions what objects were, or the object that remained in the Ark of the Covenant at that time. Do we have any record in the Word of God of what had become of the pot of manna and the budded rod of Aaron? From when it was originally put in there, and it being mentioned again there in Hebrews 9 as what was originally in that Ark of the Covenant, we don't have mention of those particular objects anymore. Something evidently had happened to that pot of manna and the rod of Aaron that budded. I mean, you can certainly consider some possible times in which that could have been removed and where it was not recovered. I mean, we know the Philistines took it. We also know that people in Beth Shemesh opened it up and looked in there. So, but we just don't have it. We have no definitive statements by God of when those particular objects were taken or removed from the ark and were gone then. But we do have a statement there, both in 1 Kings 7 and in 2 Chronicles 5, I mean 1 Kings 8 and 2 Chronicles 5, that at this time now when the ark is put into the temple, there's only the tables of stone in it. It's kind of interesting. Alright, so there we go. I don't have anything else I can add to that because God doesn't say anything more about it. But anyway, that's what was in it, as is stated there in 2 Chronicles chapter 5 and verse 10. Let's go ahead, while we're in 2 Chronicles 5, go ahead and read to the end there, verses 11 to 14. Brother Allen, can you read those for us, please?
And it came to pass, when the priests were come out of the holy place, for all the priests that were present sanctified, and did not then wait by torch, also the Levites, which were the singers, all of them of Asaph, of Heman, of Jedu, to their sons and their brethren, being arrayed in white linen, having symbols and psalteries and harps, stood at the east end of the altar, and with them 120 priests selling the trumpets. And it came to pass, as the trumpeters and singers were as one, to make one sound of the earth, praising and thanking the Lord. And when they lifted up their voice,
okay. Is God approving of this building and what's going on here and the way things are being done on this day? He's signifying his approval, isn't he? When he is filling that house with his glory by this cloud. If they were doing things in a way that was not right or in accordance with the will and authority of God at this time, they would not have been getting a cloud of God's glory like this. Something else would have happened. We've seen other cases when people did not approach the Lord and do things His way by His authority. And God very clearly signified that He disapproved and did not approve. Some of this is even a preview of the next hour, Lord willing. But when Nadab and Abihu offered strange fire before the Lord, did God approve? Obviously, in their minds, did they think there was anything wrong with what they were doing? No. Now, should they have recognized that what they were doing was wrong? Yes. They were not innocent. Was it right for God to hold them accountable for what they did? Yes. And they paid with their lives because they had done what God had not authorized in their offering. And God made that very clear, that He did not approve of what they had offered to Him in that manner as His priests. So when priests were violating God's commandments and they were not submitting to his authority, God made that clear. When Korah, of a different family of the Levites, rebelled against the authority of the Lord and his followers, and felt that he could be a priest too, did God approve of what Korah did? No. I mean, that he made the earth open up and swallow those people caught in that rebellion to prove that. And then, right after that, that's when he made Aaron's rod to bud. So God very clearly showed what was right and wrong in that situation. Then, of course, we have the situation when the Ark of the Covenant was being brought up to Jerusalem originally, when David first commissioned that to be done, and the priest didn't do it after the due order, after God's way. It didn't have the staves in the rings. There was a reason why God had commanded that there be rings in the ark, and for them to make staves, and then gave a commandment about carrying the ark, and which exactly which of the families of the Levites were to do that work. I mean, God had specified all of those things, and he had done that for a reason. Well, when David first had commanded for that ark to be brought up to Jerusalem, what was in the rings that were on that ark? Nothing. Where were the staves? They didn't have them. What were they doing? They put it on a cart, on an ox cart, to be brought, to carry that in there. Well, what did God do? Well, God made the oxen stumble, and then Uzzah, as the cart was wobbling, put it forth his hand, and he was struck dead. So did God make it clear that what he did not approve of what they were doing and how they were doing it that day? Yes, and what did he do next? Well, then David chastised the priests, rebuked them for chasing them because they had not done it God's way. And so then the second time, they did it his way, and they said that God helped them. God has always made it clear that, he is pleased with those who obey his commandments and do things the way he says they should be done. And when somebody alters that in any way, God does not approve of it. So for God to make this cloud and fill this building with his glory this time shows that he approved of what they were doing. Did that include the use of these mechanical instruments and their praising and all of this that the Levites were doing? And by the way, yes, of course, he would. I mean, if that were not authorized by God, if this were something by man's imagination, then what would God have done? Well, people would have probably been dying. There wouldn't have been a cloud filling this building with God's glory for this if this had been wrong. We also know that it was right based on a statement that we have in his word later on in this very book of 2 Chronicles that we want to turn to in just a minute, Lord willing. But before we do that, what we're reading about here in those last few verses of 2 Chronicles 5 with the organization of these Levites and how many and what they were doing, this situation, this everything was planned out for this day, who was going to be doing what. We just had a little small taste of that a week ago today. I mean, we had when you have a wedding, we have certain customs about things and who goes where and when and does what and all that kind of stuff. And we tried to do it right. But, of course, there's certain aspects of that ceremony that we have to do that God is directly involved in. There are other aspects of that that are just traditions that we follow in our culture, that all cultures have theirs for weddings. That's always been the case. But anyway, there was some organization of that. There was attempted to be, and I think it went very well according to that. But if you look at an event like that on its scale, I mean, that took planning, that took some communication and all organizing. What about this day? I mean, how much went into that? And when did it start? You remember those last chapters in 1 Chronicles? I mean, who had already organized everything? And who was going to be doing what on that day? David wasn't around to see this day, but he had prepared for it. And we have the details of his preparations, including all of this that we're reading about right there. So David's name isn't brought up over and over again in all this, but his shadow looms large over everything that was happening there, as he was the one that set everything in motion for this to happen like this. So what God is approving of this day is all this stuff that David had prepared for. That Solomon, and of course he was right to continue what his father had set in motion and to see it through the right way. So would Solomon be rewarded by God for this, the good that he did in this? Yes, but what about David and what he had done initially in preparing for all this? But you can see the... you can see the fingerprints of David all over this. And we have the details in those chapters in 1 Chronicles about that. But just before we run out of time here, I want us to take a moment and turn over to chapter 29 here in 2 Chronicles. And the use of these instruments and music and things that they were doing here in the at this time was... And this was something that was involved in the worship of God under the law of Moses. And this was something that Hezekiah did much later he had to reopen the temple that after his wicked father had closed it up. But he restored all of these, what was supposed to be done. And so what he was doing is exactly what we're reading about that was done in Solomon's time when the temple was originally opened. But verse 25 of 2 Chronicles 29, if we can have Brother Glenn read that.
And he set the Levites in the house of the Lord with cymbals, with psalteries, and with harps, according to the commandment of David and of Gad, the king's seer, and Nathan the prophet. For so was the commandment of the Lord by his prophet.
So did David just invent using instruments of music and all this? Did he just come and say, I think that would sound really nice. I think it would be great if we could get some harps in there and some trumpets and all of these other things and then do it this way. I just think that would sound great. Was that just how he did it, where he decided on his own what he thought would be good and just decided to do that? If that had been the case, what would have happened? Well, that's really what Nadab and Abihu would have done, right? I mean, how would David have been any different than they had been if that was the basis of what he did? And how many things do people do today and say, well, I just think this would be great as far as what they're doing for the Lord, and then they decide that it's okay and just use their imagination and do whatever without regard to what God says in his word? Is it up to us? Do we tell God what he's going to accept and what he's going to be pleased with and then order him to show his approval of that? Doesn't work that way. That's completely backwards, isn't it? We have to listen to God and what he says about things. He's not going to listen to us dictating to him. He dictates to us and tells us, here's what I want you to do. Here's the way I want you to do it. And then it's up to us to do it that way. And how many examples do we have from the Old Testament, both on the positive side and on the negative side, to teach that lesson or principle? Well, here's another one. So with these instruments of music in the Old Testament, what we're reading about there that David obviously was involved in, it says it was God's commandment by them to do that. So that's why he approved what they were doing there in those verses there that we're reading to the end of 2 Chronicles, and his glory filled that house. All that they were doing on that day was according to God's commandment. They were doing it God's way, like God said to do it, and he approved of it, was very pleased with it. Like he will be with us if we do things his way now. But we are under a different covenant. And again, that's something we want to get into more next hour. So we'll stop here now. And we've got chapter 6 to look at, 2 Chronicles, and some more of chapter 8 in 1 Kings. Because it's all that's spread out among a couple of chapters in 2 Chronicles is within the one chapter of 1 Kings 8. So... we'll continue with that, Lord willing, next Lord's Day. Or let's see, yeah, because this will be the first Sunday of February. So next Sunday morning, Lord willing.